I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr. Thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to be with us this week. Tonight I have with us a really special guest to me because he's the husband of one of my dearest friends. And I think he has a really important message to the world, and I want to thank him for taking the time to come on and also for what I consider his bravery for what he's done. Welcome, Richard Blanco. Richard's book is The Prince of Los Cuyos, and I'll let Richard tell you who he is and what he does. Can you tell us about you, Richard, please?
Sure, Eva. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for doing what you do. My biggest claim to fame, I guess, is I was the 5th inaugural poet of the United States, presidential inaugural poet, back in 2013 for President Obama's second inauguration. Since then, I've published a small memoir on the whole experience of being inaugural poet. And most recently, and I think that's what we're here to talk about today, a memoir called The Prince of Los Cucuyos, A Miami Childhood. And that just came out basically early October. So that's where I'm at right now. I've been a busy couple of years and enjoying every bit of it. So glad to be here.
Well, I have to say, Richard, I'm a science kind of person. My background's litigation, so I'm black and white, and I don't really always get poetry stuff. But both of your books, the first one, what was the exact name of that first one?
There's been three. So one is City of 100 Fires, then Directions to the Beach of the Dead, and then probably the last one that you probably are most familiar with is Looking for the Gulf Motel.
That's right. No. The one after that, wasn't there another one after that one?
Well, there was the memoir of the inauguration, yeah, that had three poems, poems in it, I think. Yeah.
It must have been the Gulf Motel. It made me cry. It made me laugh. I read it on an airplane going from Atlanta to California. And not only did I read it on that one trip, two other of the passengers did.
So, oh, really?
It was great. I just loved it. And this one here, the new one, The Prince of Los Cuyos, I've smiled so much that my cheeks hurt from reading it.
Yeah.
I love it. It's wonderful.
I think we often forget how therapeutic and important laughter is as well. Yeah.
I was standing in the line at Whole Foods yesterday reading this book while I was there, and I was laughing, and my cheeks, were all puffed up from smiling. The man next to me said, "I got to know what it is that you're reading." So I showed him. But I just love it.
Excellent.
Tell us a little bit about how this book came to be. You talk about your grandma and who you are and how who you are as a person, who you are as a professional. How do you blend all those together in this book?
Yeah, well, I think, a lot of the themes in the memoir have been things that I've been exploring in my poetry since book one. But about maybe like 4 years ago, I realized there's a certain, so many more backstories and so many just characters that I wanted to sort of develop and people in my life that the poetry kind of, like every genre, has its limitations. So it has its strengths and its weaknesses. And I had started writing just sort of a few memories, I call them stories because they are like stories. And then I really got into it. I was having so much fun with it. And then the more I wrote, the more I realized that there was still so much that I hadn't sort of explored or had thought about, that even though the poetry sort of did a great job in sort of surfacing certain things, that there was still more to be explored. And of course, then I just got hooked on writing prose for the moment and evolving some of those same themes. Things like, one of the main characters in the memoir is my grandmother, which I've written about before in poetry, but my grandmother was a person who was very homophobic as well as xenophobic. So it was an interesting combination. And she was one of those, I think everybody has someone like this in their life that's their greatest teacher and their greatest detractor, their best friend and their biggest enemy, you know, someone who is sort of put on this earth in some ways, or that we've chosen to sort of challenge us in some ways. And I think in the memoir, as I wrote in the introduction, I wrote that this writing this book allowed me to understand her, forgive her, and finally love her, because there was so much had gone on, and I hadn't really sorted it all out. So that's one of the main elements of the book, in terms of sort of, it's not quite a coming out story. Well, what isn't a coming out story, but how we grow up with sort of a kind of consciousness of knowing that we're a little bit different somehow, and how my grandmother was influential in trying to negotiate that, or, you know, stifle that, or really. And then there's the piece of that, you know, we're such complex human beings. We can't separate, you know, we have so many hats. I mean, I'm always sort of called out in the media for having, you know, being the first gay inaugural poet, the first Latino, the first immigrant, and all this stuff. But really, they're all hats that are, they're all one big hat, not separate hats. And so what I became interested is in seeing in this memoir how all those stories are really one story, the complexities that make each one of us. And if we really think about it, each one of us is this unique recipe, right? This unique confluence of experiences and people and relationships and memories, and how all those things sort of affect one another and really tell one story. And I hadn't done that before, and the memoir allowed me to sort of take a really broad picture of how all these things are interconnected, and also the beginnings of what is my artistic identity and my life as how those choices came to be that are influenced, again, by my culture, by my socioeconomic status, by my homophobic grandmother. So how did little Ricky, as I call myself in the memoir, end up becoming a poet? In some ways, we see the beginnings of that in the memoir, which was only until age 17, which is sort of a very, very critical sort of watershed moment for all of us, I think, right around, you know, the time we graduate or about to graduate from high school. So long answer, but yeah, all those things I became interested in exploring. And it's really funny when you sit down to write a memoir, and as most of us probably think about our own lives, you know, we think, oh, nothing really interesting happened, or I just have a plain old life, you know. But when you really sit down to think about your life, you realize that there is no life like yours, you know, and that there's really everybody has a unique story to tell.
You know, there's two phrases in this newest book, and the other book, the book that I was talking about, is One Day for All of Us.
Yeah, that's
I just want to make sure the people out there know that title exists. But there are two phrases that you use in this book, whether they were yours or someone else's, but I thought they were very valuable phrases, and I'm going to borrow them for the rest of my life, if that's okay. And
sure.
One of them is about your story with Yetta.
Yeah.
And the very profound thing that she said, change can't be changed, Richard.
Yeah.
One day when you're old like me and look at the world, not like what it is, but what it was, you'll know what it means. And then that brings me to thinking how, as an immigrant, as a Cuban, as a gay man, as whatever, as, you know, me, a divorced woman, or whatever it is that somebody wants to touch to us, change is going to happen. And to be more tolerant of that, nobody's going to change that. It's just going to come. And it seems like it'd be a lot easier for people to accept that change will happen. So can you talk to me about what that means to you?
Sure. I mean,
change in your life, and how change in general can affect the whole world.
Yeah, certainly. Well, Yetta is a very special character and a very special person in my life, and sort of she's one where a lot of change has happened to. She's an elderly Jewish woman from the old South Beach before it was South Beach back in the day, growing up and sort of connecting with her. And of course she's seen everything from, you know, you can imagine. So she becomes sort of a little bit of a mentor in the book and says that wonderful phrase. I think, you know, extrapolating out of that, what I've always sensed in my life or I've always picked up is that there's this sort of an interesting tension in our lives, right? There's this need to be consistent and predictable and stable and have some kind of knowing, you know, when we wake up the next morning, what we're going to be doing, knowing where we're going to, and yet this incredible need to always have change and have things always fresh and new and exciting, and also the fact that, as you were saying, that change, you know, how do we manage the change that happens to us? Not necessarily the change that we affect, but then also the changes that happen to us through circumstances and whatnot. And I think it's just one of those careful balancing acts. You know, too much instability can also lead to not feeling so great. So I think it's a balancing act to always recognize that in one's life, that change is something that we crave, something that is not always easy to adjust to, but that's the only thing that really defines us. In some ways, I always look toward nature in that respect, you know, as an analogy or as a metaphor. So, you know, I used to live on the beach, and every morning you wake up and the beach was somehow different. The air smelled different, or the clouds were different, or the sun rose a different way, or the seagulls were, you know, in a certain part of the beach, or there was debris from a storm overnight. And this is always different. Every single morning it was different. And yet every single morning it was still the beach. And I've tried to follow that in my life, that how do you constantly be new and change and roll with the changes and yet have a center that says, this is who I am, and everything else can happen, but this is who I am. And that part of us that in some ways is eternal and unchangeable, that little, our consciousness, basically, that really is primordial and eternal. And that is, by definition, unchangeable because it's eternal. So.
Now, there's one other thing about change that just occurred to me. Because I know, you know, your partner, Mark, so I kind of know the life that you live, and I know from your book the life that you used to live. You came from a life where money didn't flow freely.
Mm-hmm.
Now you and there was this great appreciation for whatever it was that you had. Now I know that you live a life where, you know, you're the president's inaugural poet, so I imagine you get to see a lot of other kind of people now. That's a huge change in your life. How did you deal with that, and what words do you have to say to people who may already be in that fast-running, fast crowd?
Yeah.
Who look maybe not correctly at the people who are where you used to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think so. I think it's part of it is I thank God that this sort of explosion of what happened to me in my 40s, because I think I had more maturity to deal with it and not get lost in the distractions that come my way as a result of this. And there's a lot of great things that happen too, but it, you know, all great when things happen so fast and sort of all at once, it can be very bewildering unless you sort of have that, you know, that center again, which I think is, you know, regardless of, like, we're talking about the changes that happen on the outside, there's still some center of gravity that I think I was able to am still able to hold on to. And it hasn't been easy. It has had its challenges. But I always come back to center and realizing, what are those things that are important to me, or the things that have always been important to me, and who I am essentially. And The most important thing at the end of the day is work. By that I mean to keep on creating. Like, creating is what keeps me balanced and sane, and always being on the edge of something new and different and exciting is in some ways very stabilizing, oddly enough, because it connects you to source, you know, it connects you to something that's beyond, you know, meeting Beyonce or, or, you know, hanging out with the president at the Oval Office, you know.
Yeah.
It really gives you a sense of what's really eternal and also lets you appreciate those moments in a way that perhaps you wouldn't otherwise, because you'd be so sort of anxious and on yourself, so to speak. You know, you'd be sort of not be able to enjoy those moments for the wonderful moments that they really are.
And the next thing I was going to talk to you about, which I asked you earlier, is being a gay man who's found yourself the way that you have. And it's hard for me to find words sometimes because, you know, my show is typically a science medicine show. So this is a bit different from my show, but I love what you're doing, and I'm honored and I'm grateful to be able to have access to you. So thank you. So I want to know, for people who are trying to understand, what is it? What is a gay person? Why do people think that? What is different? You know, what are they looking for? Why are they the same? I want people to understand that it's not something that you just run out one day and say, I'm going to do that. This is the way God made you. How, you know, the conversation we had earlier, how can help people understand who you are, who a gay person, regardless of the sex, is?
Yeah, sure. I think there's... You know, I mean, I'm a firm believer in some ways that, you know, there's a common humanity to us all. In some ways, you know, this question of how we're defined also in some ways overlaps into questions of race and of color and questions of even gender, right? You know, how different experiences happen and how that may define us or whatnot. But I've always striven in my work to sort of think about how we're more the same than how we're different. And, you know, in essence, a gay person is, in my experience, like anyone else, is in the sense of, you know, feeling the same spectrum of emotions: hate, betrayal, joy, ecstasy, love, hate, jealousy, all the rest. You know, in that regard, I mean, the human experience is the human experience. And the settings might change and the people may change, but it's essentially, you know, we all go through the same basic spectrum of emotions. The only way that I've been able to think about, okay, so what does make it my experience a little bit different, or something that someone who hasn't been in my shoes wouldn't necessarily have experienced? And I think it's just a heightened sense of sort of, you know, One of the hardest things in the book, in the memoir to write, was how little Ricky, as I call myself in the book, is able to know that he's different, but still has no language to understand what this word gay means or what that even really means. But just knowing that somehow he's different, that people, his grandmother's looking at him differently, this way of sort of at a very early age that you have to engage with the world, knowing that there's something different about you that is not the expected. And so from a very early age, you kind of grow up very self-conscious. You grow up asking very big questions at a very young age, very big life questions. I think, you know, in that way, there's a sort of a hyper sense of negotiating yourself in society, whereas perhaps, not that a straight person doesn't have to go through a certain amount of negotiation in other contexts, but that but nobody's going around asking, like, you know, you don't have to come out if you're a straight person. You don't have to announce, I've finally, you know, have language and courage and all the rest to say I'm straight, And that's a fundamental, big psychological, sociological thing that gay people have to deal with. And we have to deal with it every day still, in the sense, you know, as one of my therapists said one time, you know, we have to come out every day. You jump in a taxi cab and the taxi driver will assume you're straight and or married, or that you're going to a club to pick up chicks, you know, or something like that. I think it's something that fundamentally, the way in some ways we engage society is another dimension to it. But that's not to say that other people don't have other dimensions. I often think, you know, in terms of race, that certainly happens. In terms of even gender, like I said, that can happen. You know, how women might still have to negotiate or perceive or engage society in a way that sort of unique and different from a male who doesn't have to do the same way. So I think it's just a matter of that kind of sociological engagement and how we negotiate ourselves in society. But fundamentally, I think, you know, emotionally and all the rest, it's all the same thing. And one of the things I strive for in my work is to bring out, again, that common humanity, whether it's for someone to recognize that, you know, their family is just as kooky as a Cuban family growing up in Miami like mine, or that, you know, their grandmother is just as crazy as mine, even though they're Italian, you know, or whatever, or Anglo as, you know, off the Mayflower, you know, when we recognize that common human denominator, I think that's what's very powerful. And that's what really is at the heart, I think, of most art, you know, that it transcends the very specifics of the story that you're trying to tell, if you do it right, hopefully. I mean, that's what I strive for, at least.
And what advice, if any, would you have for parents who have a child that they know is different, or for somebody that knows that they're different who is trying to live the life they want to live in the world?
I think it's important to, it sounds a little cliche because I think it's been borrowed by a campaign ad, but that, you know, I think the campaign ad says it gets better. But I would just sort of take a twist on you'll understand everything, that everything will come into focus at some point, and that every experience that you're experiencing now, even though it might be in some ways bewildering, maybe even painful or traumatic, that in someday will all make sense, but that you have to keep on paying attention in some ways to what's going on around you. I think that's what I tried to do in the book, in the sense of sort of gather how all these, you know, coming out is really the final step of a thousand little teeny events in your life, you know, an engagement with a conversation with somebody, something you hear on TV, whatnot. It's a series of carefully negotiated experiences that you've had. And so I would just say pay attention and know that it'll all make sense. It all come together someday. As far as for parents, this is something that's interesting to me because even with the editor of the book, I had a little bit of, she was an amazing editor, and there's only this one point where we couldn't sort of connect a little bit. And it was, she would constantly say something like, but doesn't Ricky know he's gay already? Why doesn't he say that to himself, or something like that? And it was hard for me to explain, but I did, and she totally got it. Was that even though you know you're different, you don't have the language for it, that it's still so terrifying. Even though, you know, there's every indication that, you know, this is not a changeable characteristic, or it's not a changeable thing, that it's very part of your consciousness, that there's still, you can't have that conversation with yourself till you're ready. I think things, of course, have changed. There's a whole different era than when I grew up. And I mean, coming out in high school for me was certainly not, you know, not even a remote, that wasn't even like, those words didn't even exist. You know, there's nobody came out in high school. So I would say to parents that remember that they still, you know, gay kids still have to go through their process, even though society and even though it's gotten better, that they have to go through their own mental processes to be comfortable with themselves when they want to come out, if they want to, when they want to, because you can't really force that, and you need to support them, but you need to let them go through their own negotiation, because in some ways it's that you figure out at that age is important and will last for the rest of their lives. So you know, to just, I sort of understand that it's not easy. Even today it's not easy, and that it's not something that, you know, like you said earlier in the interview, like you just don't wake up one day and like go, oh, I'm going to come out. Like, I think I'll come out next Tuesday. Seems like a good day. I'm not busy. You know, like, it doesn't happen that way.
So you, in your book, you talk about how when you went to Disney World or Disneyland, whichever one it was, and you got your Mickey Mouse doll.
Yeah.
Well, there's that thing, and then when your cousins came to visit from New York, and they got off the airplane, and she had her makeup box in her hand, and you could think about was you could play with her mascara and her eyeshadow. When you were a child, and your abuela, if that's right, your grandma knew that you were different. Would it have been good for her to nurture you in that way and let you do those things, or did it turn out to be best that she did it the way she did it and discouraged those things? What would have been best for you or another person in that case for a parent to look at?
You know, it's really interesting, because it's a question that I ask myself a lot, and of course there's no sort of final answer, because you can't go back in time and change things and see what the effect would have been exactly, but I do think about it. You know, in some ways my grandmother, with her sort of constant surveillance and sort of, you know, trying to make me into a little man, you know, in her eyes, in some ways she was responsible inadvertently for making me a writer, in some ways, because what happened is I became more self-conscious and more withdrawn and became more of an observer of the world, and more versus more of a participant. And I learned how to read people at an early age, because I had to read them emotionally to understand if I was doing something wrong, if I was acting queer, or was I going to get called a name? I didn't know. So in some ways, what do writers do? They sit back and observe the world and you know, become great studies of human nature, right? So in some ways, that her surveillance and whatnot, in some ways, made me a writer. Now, I don't know. Gosh, would I've loved to have spared all the trauma and all the feeling horrible about myself whenever she'd, you know, call me a name, or whenever, you know, she'd chastise me for doing something that I didn't even really know was, you know, I don't even know at that age, this is male, this is female, this is gay, this is straight. I don't know those boundaries. Would I have liked to have been spared that? Probably. Would I have been a writer? Probably. I may have found something else to sort of focus my energies on, but I often wonder about that, because I think the real lesson is to, and sort of always, whatever's happened, to use a cliche, the silver lining around that. And that it took me, you know, several years to see what that silver lining was. And it was that in the bottom line, my grandmother in some ways made me a writer, made me a more thoughtful and more kind human being in a way, made me a more empathetic human being, inadvertently, through her sort of wanting me to shake me up.
Richard?
Yes?
Hello? Oh, I sounded like I lost you, and I know you're on a cell.
Yeah, I think we did for 1 second.
So what has the world that you're in now for you, the world with the president, the world with the movie stars, and the world of the scientists, what has that done for you that enhanced your child from what the things that you learned from your childhood? Or exacerbated, or whatever word that goes in that blank. What is the quantum leap there? Is there things that happened there to make that quantum leap to go from that little insecure Ricky to this famous man now who's our fifth inaugural poet? Has that changed you?
I think it's,
or has it changed you?
No. I think it's. I mean, a lot of these things that I'm speaking of were things that I have thought about already. And in some ways, they prepared me very well for what's happened. In some ways, you know, that sense of groundedness again. You know, there's things that I had thought about, and so I felt I was a little more sort of grounded and balanced. And so I think that has helped me to navigate this whole brand new world. But I often, you know, I often marvel at the irony that here was this, you know, little chubby, or as my mother says, husky, in the memoir, how she mispronounced husky, kid, you know, from a working class immigrant family, from a grandmother who made him so afraid of himself that, you know, he, for many years, you know, I would walk behind, you know, I wouldn't walk in front of people, I'd walk behind them, you know, just so self-conscious. That the irony of this little kid that grows up to then read a poem to 850,000 people and 40 million more on TV is just mind-boggling to me. But it's you know, in a sense, it's because I had, you know, there's always work to do, and I don't mean to come across it like I've done all the work and I know everything I'm doing and everything I've talked about and all the rest. There's still new work to be made and to be done. But certainly I had done a lot of work up to that point, and I think, you know, it just boggles my mind to think that I was able to do that, and the irony of, you know, how I was afraid to even talk, you know, earlier in my life as in my childhood. So I guess I did find the lesson in all of my childhood, and not just my grandmother, but in the rest, and lessons about being proud of who I was, lessons about, you know, honesty, lessons about authenticity and sincerity, and, you know, all positive lessons too that I think are all in the memoir that allowed me to be this person now. And I take with me, and I can sort of keep my balance and have a little more objective sense of everything that's happening. One of the main things that I think, you know, it has been sort of a big quantum leap, and one of the main things that I take from my childhood and from my book, from the memoir, is that sense of that in order to sort of have some balance, as my mom taught me, you know, there's always this sense of altruism, or of that if something great happens to you, that somehow you got to make that great thing happen even greater for more people around you and what you care about, and sort of focusing in on having a larger purpose in your own sort of advancement, or your own, oh, look at me, I met so-and-so, or look at me, I'm an inaugural poet, you know, that sense that, you know, that there's larger things, that there's larger purposes to be had, and take those experiences and use them as, in some ways, like a springboard to be able to sort of make even bigger things happen for whatever you care about. And for me in particular, it has to do with poetry and poetry education and literacy. And so those are things that I'm thinking about now. And I think that keeps me sane and gives me perspective, really, in terms of everything that's happened.
Before we hang up tonight, consider reading a paragraph from something. I'm not going to put you on the spot to that now in case you don't have anything, but if you have something lying around, that would be nice. Otherwise, our next question is, building off what you just said, that whole paragraph that you just gave me, did you plan, was it ever in your consciousness, did you ever intentionally try to manipulate the universe so that this would be your path? In other words, do you believe that we have free will and that you manifested this thing, or is this something that just dropped in out of the universe? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Did you ever dream of this?
Not in particular, but something happened. Something very interesting happened in October, which I got the phone call in December of 2012. In October of 2012, I'm constantly working on my spirituality, working on those questions like you just asked me, you know, and trying to find that balance between do I affect the universe, or, you know, to what degree, you know, what's going on here, you know, the phrase "the art of allowing" came into my life, which I think is just a perfect, perfect phrase, because it says both things. It says, yes, I have free will, but it's the will is to allow great things to happen to me. But I think sometimes we get a little carried away with free will, like, you know, a little too specific or a little bit too hung up on this idea of I want this and this and this and that to happen. And of course, even though we're saying those things, underlying all that is usually a lot of fear that those things won't happen. But this idea of just sitting in your, keeping your center and saying, I'm going to let wonderful things happen. I'm going to allow them to happen. I'm not going to block them. I'm not going to stand in my own way. That is really, really powerful, because it's humble at the same time. And I think the universe likes humble. It's not just like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And so in October, to get back to the story, in October, after my second book of poetry, I'd been, I want to win the Pulitzer Prize, and I want to do this, and I want to do that, and I would write this, and I would download these goals and all this stuff. And I'm not saying all that wasn't in some ways necessary to point me in the right direction, but I was just had this lucid moment that said, Richard, you know, you've been saying all these things, but you haven't been allowing them. And it was as clear as I remember exactly where I was standing, and I remember just like these sort of the clouds parting, the clouds of bewilderment parting, and saying, you know, you've just been lying to yourself. You've been saying you want these things. You've been saying you need these things, but you're just scared. You're not letting them happen because you're not. And I said, you know what? I love what I do as a poet. I love my fellow poets. I love this endeavor, this human endeavor of trying to seek truth and understanding and all the rest. And I'm going to keep on doing this. If the world listens, fine. If the world doesn't listen, fine. I'm not going to try to control that. I'm just going to show up. I'm going to show up and allow. And there I did. I didn't envision being an inaugural poet. I didn't envision being winning a National Book Award. I just said, just let it be. And then 2 months later, I get that phone call. And I can't help but think that and, you know, spiritually, energetically, however you want to put it, that had something to do, that opening up. And I think it's a lesson we have to keep on learning, because, you know, to get back to your earlier question, I think what's happened with all this hoopla is that I have that space has been a little shattered, a little juggled, right? So now I find myself trying to manipulate a little bit more. I'm going to do this project, or I want to do this next, because suddenly there's a billion opportunities that weren't there before. And so I have to remember to follow that instinct and allow and to be and explore and, you know, show up, but to stop trying to old white knuckle it, or, you know, in the name of, you know, of my free will, and really white, what I'm really doing, it's just panicking and white knuckling things. I'm going to tell the universe what I want, and it's going to listen. You know, so, I mean, there's a fine line between that and really just and letting go of the fear.
So basically, you did no physical acts. You wrote no letters. You made no phone calls to make this happen. It just happened when you allowed.
Yeah, as far. Yeah, as far as, like, there's no process, there's no application, there's no shortlisting. It's just kind of comes to you.
Certainly a lesson to those out there in the world who are trying to do something and nothing's happening.
Right. And also, you know, but, you know, it's always a constant, you know, we're never going to get it 100%. I mean, that's perfectly fine. But, you know, all throughout the years, I've always picked up a book, you know, here and there, and I've always listened to tapes and things to try to always keep my spiritual center balanced and in tune. Just some days, some months or years, I've strayed terribly, you know, but it always is about always remembering that's important. And I think that I have done pretty much consistently throughout my life. So you could say that, you know, a lot of what I had done led up to that in a way, not necessarily that I wrote a letter to the president or something like that, but that sense of always being, examining yourself and your life and your place in the universe and taking a pulse on your spiritual self, you know, that's always important. And I constantly do that. It's very important to me, and not just because of gain, but just because to be happy where I'm at the moment. And it's not always about what's coming tomorrow, but to appreciate and be incredibly grateful and alive in the moment with what you have and who you have and what's going on around you at that very moment in your life.
So this is, remember at the beginning of the show, I said there were two sentences in your book that I really liked.
Yeah. This is
the next one. Would I ever dare to disturb the universe? So what is your plan? What, I won't say plan because I know you probably don't have plans, like I would imagine, but what is that thing that you're going to disturb in the universe next? Is it something for mass consciousness, for poet? I mean, for you know, underprivileged or literary writers, or what is your thing you're going to disturb in the universe now, Richard?
Yeah. Do I dare disturb the universe? Yeah, that's.
I love it. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's still one of my favorite poems by T.S. Eliot, The Love Song of Jaffa Prufrock, which deals with sort of a man, you know, at the crux of these questions in his life, and sort of some questions that we continually ask, I mean, because there's nothing, because everything changes. The only thing that doesn't change is change, so the question becomes relevant again. But I think I have so many possibilities on the table, but there's two very strong things that I think are happening and have continued to live in me. One is, you know, really working towards how we can change the experience of poetry in middle school and high school, because I was one of those kids in a way that was never read a living poet till, you know, I was in my grad school in creative writing. And so I've gone back in my life and thought about how amazing and how much poetry enriched my life when I did discover it. And as I had seen maybe many people share with me their stories, like you just did, of how, you know, I had never read poetry before and suddenly realized what an important connection they make. So I'm hoping that that's something that I can affect by thinking about teacher training, thinking about other things. And it's too complicated to get into, but it's something I've been working at steadfastly. And that's, again, sort of that greater good. I found there was this larger purpose to serving as an inaugural poet, which was to give that gift that was given me forward, and that's the gift of poetry, and share that and have other people experience poetry in their life and not just mine. That's one important thing. And the other thing is on the humorous side, believe it or not. I'm dying to, I don't think sort of television has ever gotten sort of the Latino experience right. And by not getting it right, I mean that they've not really, you know, made that, you know, underlying human connection as I always try to strive to write toward. And so I'm thinking of, there's a small conversation, but I think I'm thinking of how we can turn the memoir into a TV series that sort of explores these experiences as a gay Latino child growing up and sort of have that conversation and let America have that conversation. But I see it as a very humorous thing too. It's something that I'm you know, came out mostly in the writing of the prose and the memoir, a humorous side to dimension to my psyche that I hadn't really explored in the art. So I think that's what I'm most curious about right now, those two things, and hopefully...
Great. I have to be honest with you something, Richard. I'm from the South, and mm-hmm. you know, born here, grew up in the Bible Belt, and I didn't really know any Latinos growing up, you know, and I don't really know many now that I'm an adult, because I'm quite reclusive, as I know that you probably know. So I don't really
right.
see a lot of people outside my immediate circle of friends and family. What I do hear is everything on the news about the Mexicans crossing the borders and the Mexicans doing this and the Mexicans doing that, whatever it is.
Right.
Your book brought family to my mind when I think of a Latino. It was me and my family just
yeah.
in your book. It was fabulous.
Oh,
I just love it. It's just fabulous. I mean, it was the same kind of stories, the same complaints by the parents, the same things they were laughing to. It was wonderful.
Yeah, you bring up a very good point. I mean, one is, again, I always strive to write, you know, West Side Story, for example, is Romeo and Juliet, retold again, right, in Spanish Harlem. I mean, the themes of being a human being are perennial. They're eternal. We're all experiencing the settings change, the characters change, but it's all underlying the same. But what you did bring up, an important point, is that one of the things why I want to do that TV show is to hopefully help in shifting that conversation in America about immigration and about immigrants and about Latinos. It seems that that's really clouded in the political arena, that it's all about, you know, it's this one-dimensional conversation, whereas you know, the experience of being Latino in the United States is so much more than that one dimension, and so much. I mean, not to belittle that experience or whatnot, and I know that it's real, but that's all we seem to talk about. You know, should we let them in or not let them in? It's like this sort of to a point absurd conversation, because in some ways the experiences and the contributions and the ways in which Latinos in the United States are already part of the United States. And there's this weird assumption that should we let them be a part or not? It's like, I got news for everybody. Like, we are part of this country. I mean, for many, many decades or hundreds of years. And so just changing the conversation to realizing how, you know, a Latino family can be just as quirky as a Southern family, you know, or, you know, and especially in America, where there's so many different kinds of experiences, and yet they're all amazing and human, right? So even if you think about, you know, the first Thanksgiving, the meanings of two different people coming together and realizing what they have in common. This is at the core of what America, in some ways, fundamentally and at least idealistically stands for, this idea that people from all over the world have come together to say we are all the same, and yet celebrate how we're all sort of different. And and I think that's one of the things I want us to sort of change that conversation and stop sort of thinking of Latinos just equated with this idea of they're coming in through the borders. You know, it's like there's a lot more complex than that. and I'm not going to get too much into it, but you know, I think the conversation is a little skewed, and it's, you know, it's time we have a different conversation. I think that's what happened. I think that shift we saw with our LGBT community, right? The idea of marriage equality changed the conversation. It isn't about gay marriage, and it isn't about, you know, it's about marriage equality, and it's about freedom to love, you know, and it's about being human. And that changed the conversation, and we can see the result that the change in rhetoric has had throughout the country. So that's what I'm hoping a show like that can do, and do on a scale that would really, you know, really have an impact.
Well, I would watch it. I didn't even, when I first met you, 15 years ago, I didn't even know you were a Latino. I didn't care. You were just Richard, you know, wonderful Richard. Anyway, we have about 6 minutes. Do you have anything you can read or recite or not?
I
It's okay if you don't.
I don't have anything with me because I'm in my house in Maine, and I'm sort of half in Maine and half in Boston now, and I have things in boxes and stuff. I'm not sure what I would read, or I don't even have a book lying around.
You just moved me. So I had never heard, like you said, a live poet do anything until that All of Us book, and it changed me forever a little bit. And now,
yeah.
I'm not going to keep you going because I don't have much time. I have to tell you, from now on, every Thanksgiving, what I'm going to think about when it's the day for me to cook my turkey is little Ricky riding down the middle of a main street with his turkey flying over the roof.
Right. It is funny that I've often one of my dear friends and mentors is from Asheville, North Carolina, and we've often had great conversations laughing at how I'm finding those commonalities that we would have never guessed at. Something as strange as a Cuban and a person from Asheville, North Carolina would have.
Well, that's not far from my mountain house. Who is it? Is it somebody I know?
The family name is Pyron.
Okay, I don't think
Pyron,
so.
Yeah.
Not far, but from one, an hour maybe. Sorry, go ahead.
One of the things was that one time I went over his house and he still had the plastic on the lampshades. And like, of course, in my family, it bewildered me as a child of like, why do we keep the plastic on the...
That brought back so many memories to me. My neighbors used to have that plastic on their car seats, and I went straight to the second grade riding in their car when you talked about that.
Right. and it was the same sense of, you know, of protecting and I guess preserving, you know, what we have is a socioeconomic issue. You know, you know, my parents could only afford to buy one lamp every 10 years. You know, you had to make that thing last. And like, I just started cracking up. Like we just realized like how different people can be and how alike our motivations and our experiences can be at the same time. And it's delightful. And I think that's what's beautiful about America in a way. I mean, I know there's a lot of work to do and we're not quite there yet, of course, and there's a lot of pushback, but in some senses, you know, that is the ideal. I mean, that's what I try to sort of push forward and to my writing and to whatever I represent, is to keep on making us connect as human beings first. And I think when you do that, a lot of the other issues will sort of fall into place.
Yes.
I think the only way to make a better world in a way is to make a better human being. And if we each focus on our lives, I think we'd see things much more clearly. And that's part of what art does and what writing hopefully does.
We have about 3 minutes, and I'm going to ask you one more question that might help you influence the lives of other people uniquely. As a gay man who has come of his own and actually found a partner and gotten to have their dream and marry that partner, do you have any words of wisdom to other gay people that might be trying to have that dream? Whether it's advice to get along or advice to whatever it is.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess it's advice that might apply across the board, but one of the ways that I knew I was in love, and I keep on coming back to this with my relationship with my partner, is that it all comes down to values. Mark is Polish, from Polish descent, German and French Canadian. Has nothing to do with being Cuban, has nothing to do he doesn't even speak Spanish, but fundamentally we hold the same values. And I think that's what keeps a relationship going, a romantic relationship or even a friendship, is that no matter what, I know that Mark is values the same things that I do. And when I met his family, that was certainly even more evident. Talking about seeing something and something so different, like you did in my book, I walked into his house, and I could have walked into my own mother's house. You know, it was the same feeling, the same sense of nurturing, the same sense of chaoticness, the same feeling. They were the same people, and so I realized why I had fallen in love with Mark was that we share very much the same values, and look for that, because commonalities on the surface don't mean much. You know, you don't, you know, those things are superficial, or they're not as lasting as that, those core values.
I can't thank you enough for making time for me and my listeners, Richard.
That was great. I always love it, Eva.
I always love to have you, too. I get to talk about things that I never get to talk about.
Me, too.
Tell us where to find your book, by the way.
Anywhere online, it's all over the place, really. I do have signed copies available on the website if any interest to anyone that's a little bit different. But you know how it is nowadays. You can get a book
almost
anywhere.
What's the website?
Richard-Blanco.com. And there's more about the book on there, too, as well. And, you know, of course, support your independent booksellers, which you can. And that's always wonderful, too.
Thank you, Richard. Go and disturb the universe in a wonderful way.
Thank you.
Good night, my dear. Good night.
Bye-bye.